Good evening. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, NATO promises long-term military aid to Ukraine, but stops short of announcing a path for membership at the alliance's ongoing summit.
House Republicans interrogate the FBI director about claims of bias in the department and investigations into the president's family.
And the Webb telescope's images of the far reaches of space prompt scientists to reconsider their understanding of the early universe.
People are really interested in what are the surprises that we're getting out of the Webb. The big answers are the first galaxies grew differently than we expected.
Welcome to the NewsHour. President Biden is in Finland tonight after an eventful two-day NATO summit in nearby Lithuania.
Finland is the newest member of the transatlantic alliance, and Mr. Biden will celebrate that tomorrow. But there was still much to do on this second day of the NATO summit as the alliance expands in the face of Russia's ongoing invasion of Ukraine. Our Laura Barrón-López was there.
We're not going anywhere. You're stuck with us.
A warm moment between wartime partners after a tense 24 hours.
Thank you very much that all these days you are with us. I mean, you and Americans.
President Joe Biden, for the first time, publicly hinted that Ukraine's NATO membership could come sooner than previously thought.
I hope we finally have put to bed the notion about whether or not Ukraine is welcome in NATO. It's going to happen. We're moving. You're all moving in the right direction. I think it's just a matter of getting by the next few months here.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky arrived for summit meetings with a softer tone and clear-eyed that membership in the midst of war was off the table.
What we hear and understand that we'll have this invitation when security measures will allow.
He did secure commitments from the U.S. and other Group of Seven leaders that look ahead. A joint declaration pledged long-term security assistance designed to help Ukraine defend itself against future attacks.
We're going to help Ukraine build a strong, capable defense across land, air, and sea. It'll be a force of stability in the region and deter against any and all threats.
That announcement helped cool tensions from yesterday, when Zelensky called the absence of a clear timeline for Ukraine to join NATO absurd.
Morning.
But today, Zelensky greeted NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg with a hug. The two agreeing, the summit sent a clear signal.
Today, we meet as equals. I look forward to the day we meet as allies.
I'm confident after the war, Ukraine will be in NATO.
This is truly a historic moment.
And they gathered for the inaugural meeting of the NATO-Ukraine Council.
Vladimir, it's great to have you here.
A new panel designed to grant Zelensky more power in some NATO decisions. But the war is in its 504th day. Its toll on Ukrainians evident in Zelensky's persuasion campaign for weapons. He praised President Biden for the decision to send cluster munitions to the front lines.
And this is about justice. We defend ourselves. We're defending ourselves without using appropriate weapons on the territory of other states. As for the rest of the aid, we need long-range weapons. This deficit hasn't gone away, and I will raise this question.
While Ukraine dominated the agenda in Vilnius, the alliance also took steps to fortify its own members' borders.
Our security is interconnected.
For the first time since the Cold War, they approved new defense plans in case of an attack on NATO territory. They reinforced a 2% of GDP defense spending minimum. So far, just 7 of the 31 member countries hit that target. They also hosted Indo-Pacific leaders to deepen global ties against other adversaries, including China, and saw a deal struck for Sweden's NATO membership. Though Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said today his country will not immediately vote on it.
Now we have a two-month parliamentary vacation. Our goal is to finish this job as soon as possible.
Hello, Lithuania!
In a post-summit speech, President Biden celebrated NATO's unity in downtown Vilnius.
Strong alliances, versatile partnerships, common purpose, collective action to meet our shared challenges.
Continuing the victory lap for NATO's expansion, President Biden travels to Finland tomorrow, his first presidential visit to the newest member of the NATO alliance.
Moments before boarding Air Force One to Helsinki, President Biden said that they accomplished every goal that they needed to at the summit, and that Ukraine now understands that it's more important for them to get military aid than to be concerned about the timeline for their NATO membership. Amna?
Laura, that NATO summit began with a tense 24 hours between Presidents Biden and Zelensky that seems to have since shifted. But what's the status of the relationship between the two leaders post-summit?
That's right, Amna. President Zelensky went from calling it absurd that there was no clear timeline for them to join NATO, also said that it was a sign of weakness that would encourage Russian aggression. He said that on Tuesday, and then about 24 hours later, sitting alongside President Biden, praised the president as well as Americans, and President Biden also welcomed that praise and said that they were standing by Ukraine. I spoke to Jake Sullivan today, Amna, about all this, and he said that, look, President Zelensky had the right to voice some frustration and to say that they wanted immediate NATO membership, but that ultimately it has to be agreed upon by all the 31 members of NATO.
Laura, tell us more about the next steps now for delivering assistance to Ukraine. What is the White House doing to help guarantee that assistance, both in the short term and the long term?
In the near term, Amna, it's going to be those cluster munitions that we've reported on and that Zelensky was also said are something that is very important to Ukraine to have right now. But President Biden, again, right before he boarded Air Force One, said that he was open to potentially sending long-range missiles. That's something that President Zelensky has repeatedly asked the U.S. for. And he asked again at the summit, said that he was going to bring that up with President Biden in their one-on-one. And so it was significant that the president appeared to float that as an option. Now, all of this, Amna, is with an eye towards the 75th summit, annual summit next year in Washington, D.C., where the NATO members will be checking in on Ukraine status, on reforms. But in the time between now and that next summit, they committed to Ukraine that they were going to give them more security assistance on intelligence sharing, on military aid, and on another other host of aid, Amna.
That is our White House correspondent, Laura Barone-Lopez, reporting live from Helsinki, Finland tonight. Laura, thank you. Good to see you.
In the day's other headlines, inflation in June cooled to its lowest level since early 2021, helped by easing prices on gas, groceries, and airline tickets. The Labor Department reports consumer prices rose 3% from a year earlier. That was down from a 4% rate in May, but still above the Federal Reserve's 2% target. Inflation at the retail level peaked in June of last year at an annual rate of 9%. The flooding that ravaged Vermont this week was receding today. In Montpelier, the capital, cleanup crews plowed through sludge as cars struggled to maneuver on streets slick with mud. At a briefing, FEMA Chief Deanne Criswell said it's evidence that climate change is at work and getting worse.
I have seen an increase in records being broken. Right, records that have stood for decades or even a century, and it's happening over and over again. We have to start to think about what is this going to look like in 10 years from now so we can understand what those risks are going to be, because I think what we're facing today is not what we faced 10 years ago.
Meantime, the National Weather Service issued a new round of heat alerts to more than 108 million Americans today. Forecasts called for the Southwest to break temperature records again. The European Union's Parliament has approved a major climate change bill. It would impose the world's most ambitious climate and biodiversity targets, including restoring at least a fifth of Europe's nature areas. Today's razor-thin vote highlighted divisions over the plan, with conservatives warning it'll harm farmers and fuel inflation. Microsoft reports a Chinese-based hacking group has breached email accounts linked to government agencies in the U.S. and Western Europe. The company says the intrusions went undetected for a month. The State Department says it cannot confirm China was involved, but has no reason to doubt Microsoft's claim. Beijing dismissed the accusations as disinformation. North Korea is drawing fresh condemnation after firing its first intercontinental ballistic missile in 3 months. It blasted off near Pyongyang today and flew for 74 minutes before landing in the Sea of Japan. That's the longest flight time yet for a North Korean test. South Korea's president reacted in Lithuania, where he and the Japanese prime minister attended the NATO summit.
North Korea launched an intercontinental ballistic missile again. This is a threat to peace and stability in the region and the world. It is also a provocation and an obvious violation of UN resolutions.
The North Koreans had accused the U.S. of sending spy planes into their airspace in recent days and had threatened retaliation. Back in this country, Hollywood actors could join striking screenwriters in walking out as a deadline looms at midnight Pacific time. The SAG-AFTRA Actors Union agreed to let federal mediators intervene in a final effort to reach an agreement, but they said they're not hopeful. They're demanding better pay and safeguards around studios' usage of artificial intelligence. On Wall Street, the inflation numbers helped stocks gain a bit more ground. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 86 points to close at 34,347. The NASDAQ rose 158 points, and the S&P 500 added 33 points. And a passing of note, the Czech-born novelist Milan Kundera has died in Paris, where he lived for decades. His work explored humanity and depicted the struggles of living under totalitarian rule. His best-known work, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, was centered in Czechoslovakia after Soviet tanks crushed a pro-democracy movement in 1968. Milan Kundera was 94 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, Iowa Republicans pass one of the nation's most restrictive abortion bans. A podcast looks at the ongoing issue of sexual abuse in the substance recovery community. And New Orleans restaurants recycle oyster shells to help save dwindling coastlines.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
We return now to the NATO summit, what was and wasn't accomplished. We get some perspective from Ivo Dalder. He was U.S. ambassador to NATO during the Obama administration. He's now the president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Ambassador Dalder, when you look at the summit and what was accomplished, was this a missed opportunity? Should the alliance have issued an invitation or at least a timeline for an invitation for Ukraine to join?
No, I really don't think so. And it was unrealistic, frankly, to think that there would be an invitation. Making an invitation to a country in the middle of war in order to bring it into an alliance that is committed to defending every inch of the territory of all of its members was just not in the cards and couldn't be expected. What could be expected is a very strong statement and a very strong commitment to move forward with Ukraine on multiple fronts. First of all, to provide new weapons so it can launch the counteroffensive with the full backing of Western equipments, and that was done by a whole variety of countries, long-range missiles, cluster munitions, and new tanks and the like. Secondly, a long-term commitment that the United States, together with its G7 partners and others, are making to the defense and security of Ukraine, not only today and tomorrow, as long as this war goes on, but after that, to make sure that a war never resumes. And then finally, really an important indication that the issue of NATO membership is no longer a question of whether, but really a question of when and how. How do you bring in a country that is in the middle of a war with contested borders into a security alliance? That's now squarely on the agenda. As President Biden said, hopefully in the next few months, we were going to find out how we're going to do that. And that is a major step. So I think President Zelensky is going back to Kyiv full with the backing of the Western alliance. And that's a good thing because he needs that backing in order to win the war.
There was another significant summit move in Turkish President Erdogan's decision to allow Sweden to join NATO. That was just as the U.S. announces that Turkey will get those F-16s that they wanted. Is that what changed Erdogan's mind? Help us understand what happened here.
Well, reading Erdogan's mind is difficult. I mean, he likes attention. He certainly got it once again. He does this all the time. He goes to the brink of a summit in order to make sure that everybody knows that the Turks are around and are playing a big game. Secondly, I think he's now realizing that with the economy in trouble in Turkey, he needs Western assistance. He needs a good relationship with the United States, with the European Union. And third, he did get those F-16s. It now looks like the discussions between the United States and Turkey on selling those F-16s are proceeding, that the Congress is moving forward with providing those F-16s as long as Turkey commits not to use them against Greece or Cyprus. And I noted that President Erdogan said that he would not do that. So I think he's got a lot for what he wanted. But the most important thing, Sweden is now going to be a member of NATO, and that's how it should be.
As my colleague Laura Brown Lopez reported earlier, NATO leaders have also, for the first time since the end of the Cold War, they now have an approved military plan, a response plan, in case any of the NATO member nations are attacked. Why is that significant?
You know, it is significant. It's NATO is sort of relearning its muscle memory of what it means to be a military alliance. So these plans, one for the northern region, one for the central region, the eastern front, and one for the southern region, dictate what kind of forces are necessary to defend every inch of NATO territory. And it really gives an indication to all NATO members. It says, you, Germany, need to provide 150 tanks in this place, and you need to be able to move them there within this time frame with the kind of ammunition that is necessary. And that's the kind of planning that now will go on through the entire alliance. Think of it as an Excel spreadsheet with the NATO countries on representing columns and the military capability representing the capabilities. And they're now filling in exactly what capabilities are necessary to fulfill the requirement to defend every inch of NATO territory. So it merges and integrates NATO defense planning and the investment and resourcing of NATO capabilities in a much more significant way. It's what we used to do during the Cold War. We just haven't been able to do it or found it necessary to do it until Russia decided that it would use force to change borders. And that, of course, is something that NATO wants to prevent.
Ambassador, I've got less than a minute left here, but I have to ask you, of course, Ukraine dominated this summit. They're in the middle of a counteroffensive. What's your sense of how that counteroffensive is going?
So I think the Ukrainians are trying to probe for Russian weaknesses so they can then concentrate the forces that have been equipped and trained by Western countries and have a breakthrough. It's probably getting a little bit more difficult. It is a little more difficult than they had anticipated to finding that weakness. But I have no doubt that at some point you will see all of those forces that have been trained and equipped by Western countries massing and breaking through Russian defenses and making significant difference in where the front lines are going to be drawn.
That is the former U.S. ambassador to NATO, now president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, Ivo Dalder, joining us tonight. Ambassador Dalder, thank you. Good to see you.
Thank you.
The director of the FBI sat on the other side of an interrogation today by members of Congress. Christopher Wray faced some sharp criticism during today's House Judiciary Committee hearing. Congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins was there and joins us now. So, Lisa, Republicans on the committee grilled the FBI director about the alleged weaponization of law enforcement agencies against former President Donald Trump. Tell us more about that.
That's right. They were talking about not just President Trump, but also individual Americans. And, you know, this was a very dense hearing. As you will hear, there were threads of many different issues that overlapped. When it came to that Republican accusation of weaponization by the FBI, they made a few specific allegations. They brought up memos by the FBI that were protecting school boards rather than parents, sort of implying that parents were the threat. The Department of Justice has denied that that was their intent. Also, a memo from the Richmond FBI that targeted what they called
radical traditional Catholics. Director Wray said that that was a single office and not at all what the FBI intended. But one of the most heated exchanges came around the case of a man named Mark Houck. He's a Pennsylvania man who was arrested and charged after he protested or was standing outside of an abortion clinic. And when he was arrested, his lawyer said he was willing to voluntarily come in, but instead the FBI sent over a dozen agents and held him at gunpoint in the morning before his family. And Director Wray was asked, was that appropriate?
I'm not going to second guess the judgment of the career agents on the ground who made the determination.
But your job is to second guess and look at what they are doing. Your job is to review what they do. Your job is to protect the American people from a tyrannical FBI storming the home of an American family.
I could not disagree more with your description of the FBI as tyrannical.
I don't believe it's tyrannical that FBI agents were a part of storming a father's home in suburban Philadelphia?
I'm the gentleman.
Mr. Chairman.
Time of the gentleman's expired. The witness may respond, and then we'll move to our next witness.
Sir, respectfully, member. They did not storm his house. They came to his door. They knocked on his door and identified themselves. They asked him to exit. He did without incident.
Now, that was a classic example of what Wray did. He never lost his cool in this hearing. Democrats did do some defense work for him, charging Republicans with being political in their attacks.
What about the more bipartisan concerns about the ways in which the FBI is using data?
This was a fascinating part of the hearing and obviously of increasing importance now. Democrats raised their concern that we now know that the FBI and other agencies have been collecting data on Americans. They asked exactly what the FBI has done with that data. Republicans, too, chimed in. They raised a recent court filing that, in fact, found that the FBI was inappropriate, in fact, broke the rules of how it was using warrantless wiretaps in some cases after January 6th. In both of these instances, the FBI director said he wasn't either going to get into specifics for legal reasons, ongoing cases, or he said it was just too complicated to get into. But the Republicans also raised this case of sort of a wide-ranging voluntary data ask. The Bank of America Republicans showed this email that the FBI used to try and get a wide range of data from everyone who had a transaction with a Bank of America card between January 5th and 6th of 2021, or anyone who had purchased a weapon potentially in the entire country in the 6 months previously. Republicans say that's an example of just a very wide FBI search of what information they think should be private. The director himself just kept reiterating that the FBI does not break the law.
And hovering over all of this, Lisa, are some threats by Republicans, some Republicans on the committee, to defund the FBI entirely. Did that come up today?
Right. Hovering over all of this is the FBI's reputation and its future. And indeed, some members who have said otherwise that they would like to defund the FBI did not say that today to the FBI director's face. The closest they came was Chairman Jim Jordan, who in his opening remarks raised the idea that the FBI should not get payment for its new headquarters. Director Wray said any defunding of the FBI would be catastrophic on a range of issues and threats facing the country right now.
What else stood out to you about this hearing today, Lisa?
Yeah, there were some surprising points. One was that for the first half, I didn't really hear much about two big FBI headline cases, the one involving Hunter Biden or the one involving former President Donald Trump. It was more about other specifics, broader American concerns. One other surprising moment, Jeff, the FBI director was asked about the greatest threats that he sees. And in particular, he was asked about China. Here's what he said.
There is no country, none, that presents a broader, more comprehensive threat to our ideas, our innovation, our economic security than the Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party. And in many ways, it represents, I think, the defining threat of our era.
That was a standout quote and, in fact, changed how we were reporting this segment with you. It just shows how much the FBI is working on, the pressures on them right now, even as the director itself is facing very sharp political questions.
Congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins. Lisa, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Lawmakers in Iowa passed a bill late last night that would ban most abortions in the state after 6 weeks. Iowa is the latest in a series of Republican-led states to pass abortion restrictions since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe last year. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds is expected to sign the bill into law on Friday. Joining us now to talk about the nation's patchwork of abortion laws is Aaron Murphy, Des Moines Bureau Chief for The Gazette, and Sarah Varney, Senior Correspondent for KFF Health News. So, Aaron, as we mentioned, Iowa Republicans passed this bill late last night. Here is a portion of the hours of debate.
This bill, Iowa's heartbeat law, ensures that the right to life is protected. The most fundamental human right that is enshrined in both our state and federal constitutions. Neither the U.S. Constitution nor Iowa's state constitution provides any right to reproductive freedom. And frankly, when we wade past all the pretty words surrounding reproductive freedom and women's right to choose, what we find is the truth. Those are nothing more than terms used in advocating for the willingness to kill a baby through all 9 months of a pregnancy.
Abortions have always happened and will happen. The question is, will they be safe and legal? Because if they're not, women will be harmed. Some may die. Look, I guarantee you wouldn't want me flying your airplane because I'm not a licensed pilot. Or drilling on your teeth because I never went to dental school. We citizen politicians should know our place, and it's not in the exam room.
So abortion in Iowa had been legal for up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. How did lawmakers there arrive at this legislation?
So this is actually Iowa Republicans' second attempt to pass this, so what they call the fetal heartbeat bill, as you noted, what a lot of people believe can be detected at 6 weeks of pregnancy, so very early, often before the woman even is aware that she's pregnant. They passed a very similar bill in 2018, and Governor Reynolds signed it into law. Then it was immediately blocked by the courts and stayed that way until after the Iowa and U.S. Supreme Courts in 2022 delivered rulings that sort of reset the legal landscape for abortion. Obviously, the U.S. Supreme Court being the repeal of Roe versus Wade, there was a very similar ruling at the almost the exact same time by the Iowa Supreme Court. Once that kind of reset the legal landscape here, the governor asked the state courts to reinstate that 2018 law. Just this past month, the Iowa Supreme Court declined to do that in a split decision. And so Republican legislators went back to work, called the special session to once again pass this law with the expectation that it will get back to the Iowa Supreme Court again and under new kind of legal, arena will be approved this time, will be considered constitutional by the state Supreme Court. Hmm. That's the goal of State House Republicans.
How have advocates on both sides of this issue reacted to the Iowa State Legislature now passing this six-week abortion ban?
Well, what I can tell you is just yesterday during the special session, a lot of people came to the Iowa Capitol. It was a pretty remarkable scene. I've been covering the Capitol for 10 years, and I can only think of one other instance that even comes close to what I saw yesterday, just thousands of people at the Capitol, the vast, vast majority of which were abortion's right advocates. There were, the so-called pro-life, the anti-abortion crowd as well. They were there demonstrating as well, but far, far outnumbered by the abortion rights people demonstrated long and loud. They were there for 6 or 7 hours of the day. It was pretty remarkable. And we've seen public polling in Iowa that shows a majority of Iowans support abortion being legal in some or most cases. So it'll be interesting to see as this law presumably plays out in the courts. We've already just recently here heard that a legal challenge has been entered already into this new law before it's even signed into law by Governor Reynolds tomorrow. So this will go through the courts again, and it will be interesting to see how the public reacts this time around and whether it affects the elections in 2024 here.
Sarah Varney, abortion is banned in almost all cases in most of the states bordering Iowa, but abortion is protected legally in Illinois and Minnesota, two states that are led by Democrats. How might those states become destinations for Iowa women seeking abortions, and how are those states preparing?
Well, we actually have a lot of examples of what happens when a state essentially passes a ban like this. This happened in Georgia recently. We have a map, actually, we can put up that was done by my KFF colleagues in the women's health team. And you can really see this sort of sea of red. And you can see what happens now with Iowa. As you mentioned, we imagine that women will go to Minnesota and Illinois. One of the things that we've seen really is a lot of confusion about what's legal. So women even showing up at clinics in Minnesota or Illinois saying to OBGYNs, you know, I need an abortion. I know it's illegal. And the staff at the clinics having to tell these women that, no, actually here, you know, you're safe. It's legal. The other thing we're really seeing now is a delay in the procedures. So women who may have been able to get an abortion at, you know, 7 or 8 weeks, now it's at 10 or 12 or even 13 weeks and at higher risk in their pregnancy. The other thing we're really seeing, too, and this will affect these women in Iowa, is, you know, miscarriage, as we've talked about other times on the show, is incredibly common, and non-viable pregnancies. So when Iowa, when this goes into effect in Iowa, it will not just impact women who want to end early unintended pregnancies, but also women with intended pregnancies that are not progressing. So we've seen this in many, many cases, women in Wisconsin having to go to Illinois when their fetus is not developing a skull, for instance, or has no kidneys. And it's quite traumatic for these patients having to travel. The other thing that we're going to see, and we're already starting to see, is far more women actually giving birth to children that they did not intend to have. So there's some statistical modeling out of Texas recently that found, after SB 8 went into effect, which was the 6-week ban in Texas, that there's about 10,000 additional forced births that were estimated there. Just one thing to note, though, for women in Iowa and elsewhere, is that medication abortion remains legal, depends on sort of how and where you get it. There's groups like Aid Access that are continuing to mail medication abortion into states, even where it's technically illegal.
We have seen how the anti-abortion movement has really shifted to the state level after the Supreme Court overturned Roe. What can you tell us about the legal challenges to some of these state bans, to include Iowa?
Well, I mean, we've seen quite a number of successes from the anti-abortion groups recently. One thing I will mention, though, is just yesterday, a group of advocates in Idaho filed a lawsuit against Idaho's teen abortion travel ban. So this is a travel ban that went into effect on May 5th. We did a NewsHour segment about it, if anyone wants to go back and watch it. But these groups who largely work with women who are victims of domestic violence and sexual violence, there's also an abortion fund involved. They filed in federal court yesterday a lawsuit saying that this infringes on the interstate right to the right to interstate travel and infringes on the First Amendment right to free speech, saying that, you know, this law essentially chills speech around abortion. The Supreme Court has held that monies given to support speech also should be protected by free speech or by the First Amendment, rather. So this is a new challenge against this teen travel ban. And there's many state legislatures, Republican-led state legislatures, that are looking at doing this type of teen travel ban, because we've seen, you know, we've seen model legislation come from the Right to Life Committee, which is one of the largest anti-abortion groups in the country, that is essentially really looking at how can they limit travel outside of these states for women under 18 and for adults as well.
Sarah Varney, a senior correspondent for KFF Health News, and Aaron Murphy is Des Moines bureau chief for the Gazette. Our thanks to you both.
Thanks, Jeff. Yeah.
Today marks 1 year since the world first started seeing spectacular images of the cosmos that were captured by the powerful James Webb Telescope. But as science correspondent Miles O'Brien tells us, getting those images, including the newest one released today of dozens of stars being formed, is only part of the important work being done by the $10 billion telescope.
For the James Webb Space Telescope, the hits just keep coming. One riveting image after another, from the far reaches of the universe to planets right here in our own solar system. We got our first taste a year ago, and the images did not disappoint. The Carina Nebula, Stefan's Quintet. And spectacularly, this so-called deep field image, showing thousands of galaxies stretching into the distant universe.
How much stunning science was in there as well.
Well, we're still working out the details of what all those mean.
That's NASA astrophysicist John Mather. He's been a senior scientist on Webb since its inception back in the mid-1990s.
Well, I think the people are really interested in what are the surprises that we're getting out of the Webb. First, they want to see the beautiful pictures and be told what those pictures are about. And then they say, well, what's new? What did you find out that we didn't know before? And of course, the big answers are the first galaxies grew differently than we expected, and we don't know why their old predictions were wrong.
Webb is shedding light on the big answers because it is uniquely capable of seeing them. It operates in the infrared wavelength. Invisible to human eyes, this part of the spectrum is the only way to see the most distant objects in space that are moving away from us as the universe expands. Before Webb launched, astronomers used near-infrared instruments aboard the Hubble Space Telescope to see galaxies that date to about a half billion years after the Big Bang. But Webb can see a few hundred million years further back in time. Astronomers hope they might catch glimpses of the universe before stars and galaxies formed.
And yet we see galaxies already exist at that time.
Mark Postman is interim deputy director at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore.
It doesn't refute Big Bang cosmology or say we have to start from scratch. But what it does say is we do have to learn new ways of getting stars and galaxies to assemble very quickly after the Big Bang, within a couple hundred million years.
But the most interesting findings for astronomers don't come from the eye candy the rest of us gobble up. Case in point, Uranus.
I have to say the word spectroscopy because that's what these science observations were all about. We have some images and they're fine, but the spectroscopy blew us away.
Heidi Hamel is a scientist on the Webb team who focuses on solar system observations. Webb's science instruments generate spectroscopy data that astronomers use to study the chemical composition of objects in space. If we were to train one on Earth, we would detect the different compounds found here on this planet. For astronomers, a spectrograph is worth 1,000 pictures.
We are seeing evidence of chemistry that we had hypothesized. They're like textbook examples of chemistry of ethane and methane and acetylene and all this interesting dynamical stuff in the atmosphere of Uranus. And that is very interesting because that's new chemistry that we hadn't thought about.
Still, Heidi Hamel will confess to being wowed by a great image.
This is not processed at all, and then you...
I believe this has how many, a little bit of...
How many filters? Three in this? Is it always three?
This picture only had two.
Okay.
In Modesto, California, I sat down with someone who makes the visual magic happen. Judy Schmidt describes herself as a celestial artist.
How many images would you say you have processed over the years?
Oh, gosh.
Give or take.
Hundreds.
She's a stay-at-home mom with a background in graphic design. Over the years, she's made a hobby out of processing and color-correcting astronomy images in her home office, posting her work on Flickr and Twitter.
You're trying to let us see something we can't see, right? That's hard.
Yes, but there's a natural order of wavelengths. So even though it's infrared, I'm still using the same, I guess, formula to put together an image, where the shortest wavelengths will be represented by blue, and then the medium wavelengths get represented by green, and then the longest then in the red.
Among her most celebrated work, Hubble images of the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 impacting Jupiter in 1994. So when Webb scientists pulled down fresh images of Jupiter, Heidi Hamel gave Schmidt a crack at those too.
I just thought it was very fun and something to do with my life. And if I can make some astronomer's day by showing interest in their work and making a pretty image out of it, then I thought that was awesome too.
So you're like the dean of the citizen science image processors at this point. And do you imagine quitting or are you going to keep going?
I don't feel like it will ever end as long as there's space telescopes in the sky.
But there's little concern space telescopes will fade away. This is a special place if you care about astronomy and space telescopes, right?
Absolutely. This is where some of the most important observatories of our time have been put together, assembled, tested, and made ready to go into space.
I caught a glimpse of NASA's next flagship observatory under assembly at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Julie McEnery is the senior project scientist on the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope.
So if you were to compare us to Webb, Webb will look at a small region of the sky with exquisite sensitivity and sharpness. And it can tell you what's happening, you know, right at the beginning, right at the earliest times in our universe. What Roman will tell you what happened between then and now.
The team hopes to launch by 2026. There is no doubt they have a tough act to follow. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Greenbelt, Maryland.
New Hampshire's largest substance abuse treatment network has helped tens of thousands of drug users loosen addiction's hold over their lives. But a three-year investigation undertaken by a local journalist uncovered evidence that the group's founder took advantage of his position and the vulnerability of his patients and staff. Allie Rogan has that conversation and a warning that elements of this discussion could be disturbing for some viewers.
New Hampshire Public Radio investigative reporter Lauren Chulgin recently released The 13th Step, chronicling her reporting over the last few years. But the story didn't end with publication, as Chulgin found reporting on the alleged abuses left her, her family, and her news organization vulnerable as well. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us. Let's first talk about the name of your podcast, The 13th Step. What does that refer to?
Well, it refers to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's kind of a euphemism on those 12 steps as the step that comes after it. And basically what it means is that people who have later sobriety, who have, you know, been through the program, have years or months of sobriety, are then, insert verb here, preying on or flirting with or trying to start a relationship with someone who is in earlier sobriety. Now, our podcast digs into the times where that is very unwanted and very problematic. And the reason why it can be problematic is because there's a really, really difficult power differential there. Here's someone who has more footing underneath them, and a person in early recovery, I mean, that's an extremely vulnerable time. And so consent is really tricky. And I should say, like, if you've never heard this phrase before, it's likely that you're not in recovery, because people in recovery will tell you this is just the most common thing. I had someone tell me that they heard it first in the 70s. In the history of addiction treatment, you'll see it right there with the adoption of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a thing that has been around, but just a lot of us haven't been paying enough attention to see it.
Let's talk about the man at the center of the allegations in your podcast. His name is Eric Spofford. He's the CEO of one of the largest addiction recovery systems in the Northeast. Tell us about his story.
He started his company at a time when New Hampshire, like many states, but especially in New Hampshire, we really desperately needed help. He started with one small sober home, grew that company to one of the biggest providers of substance use disorder treatment in New England. And not only did he do it, but people really believed in him. Our governor says that, you know, Eric Spofford was the first person he'd call if he had questions about the opioid crisis. And Eric offered not just a story that people wanted to rally behind, but a company that he said really was doing things right. I think we have a little tape from Eric talking about, in a training video that he made for staff, how different his company, which is called Granite Recovery Centers, was supposed to be.
This company really focuses and operates on integrity. We pride ourselves on doing the right thing. We have always held a high standard of doing the right thing. In a time where addiction treatment, not everybody that does this work is doing the right thing, and we put clients over profits consistently, and we care about the people we serve.
But as I learned through my now 3 years of reporting, there was a very much another story going on here.
And let's talk about that private story that was happening behind closed doors that really contrasted with the public image that you just talked about.
Yeah, so originally, Ali, I did a story about a COVID outbreak at one of Eric's facilities. This was in, you know, December of 2020. And I got a tip soon after that, that Eric was facing multiple allegations of sexual misconduct and that he was paying women to keep them silent about these allegations. Obviously, that's a stunning email to get. And I started digging around. And so one woman I heard from, we refer to her as Elizabeth. Elizabeth told me that she was a client of one of Eric's treatment centers. And the day after she left, she started receiving explicit pictures on Snapchat from Eric.
I knew in my core it wasn't right because I know that a CEO of a treatment center I left 24 hours ago should not be sending me pictures of his dick. He shouldn't be sending me pictures of his dick even a year later. That's just integrity 101, right? I didn't want any of it. I wanted a roof over my head and food in my tummy. Like, I wanted to feel safe. So I knew not to share it.
Then I also heard from an employee, a former employee of Eric's, who says that she also received these Snapchats while she was working for him and that he sexually assaulted her in the office in the middle of the workday. I found additional allegations as well. And it just goes to show that, you know, there was a lot more happening other than the public story that many of us, including NHPR, you know, we had Eric on as an expert source during some of the hardest times of the opioid crisis. And so there was a lot of digging I needed to do to find out what was really going on here.
Let's talk about some of the underlying reasons for what makes this particular cohort so vulnerable.
Yeah, I think, Ali, a lot of the times when we talk about active addiction or we talk about addiction and substance use disorder, we think about active addiction. But we don't talk as often about once that substance has ended, it doesn't mean like, okay, your brain's back to normal and everything's fine, your life's back in order. You're basically finding out who you are all over again. And so to be have an understanding of consent when you're still rebuilding your life and trying to figure out the next phase and a healthier phase of your life, it's extremely difficult. AA or the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, while they've benefited and helped millions of people, I learned through my reporting they can also be easily exploited because of the way that the program is built. And so I spoke with a writer, Holly Whitaker, who has a book, Quit Like a Woman. Here's a little bit of what Holly said.
Shut up, follow the rules, don't complain. You know, like do your work, keep your set, you know, like all of that, which is when you take that and extrapolate that into like the entire system, you understand why people with addictions are treated as inhumanely as they're treated and not trusted and are perfect victims. Perfect victims.
Eric Spofford has denied the allegations against him, but I do want to ask about the retaliation that you and your family and your coworkers have come under as a result of your reporting. Tell us about that.
We published some of these allegations as a news story initially, and a month after that news story came out, my parents' home was vandalized, the C-word spray painted on the garage door and rocked through the window. And when I called my boss to tell him what had happened at my mom and dad's house, he said, oh my God, Lauren, that happened to my house. And then I later find out it happened at a house I used to rent. About a month later, we did have security camera footage capture that my house also was vandalized and my parents' home was vandalized again. Same thing at my parents' house, the C-word on the garage, brick or rock thrown at the window. But at my house, a brick was thrown through this like big, beautiful picture window in my living room, and the words "just the beginning" were spray painted under my house. It was obviously a pretty harrowing thing. At the time, you know, I didn't know what really had happened or why, but my instinct was that it was in response to the reporting. I've never in my, you know, 10 plus years in this field faced anything like that. And it has been quite difficult.
Mm. The podcast is The 13th Step. It is a riveting listen. Lauren Chulgen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And we should add that federal prosecutors have charged three men with alleged ties to Spofford in connection with the vandalism. Spofford did not respond to the NewsHour's multiple requests for comment, but in a since-dismissed defamation suit he filed against Chulgen and NHPR, his attorneys wrote this, quote, "From top to bottom, both the article and the podcast falsely state and imply that Eric sexually harassed one woman and sexually assaulted two others. Each NHPR defendant knew or recklessly disregarded that these claims were false."
In the last century, more than 2,000 square miles of Louisiana's coastline have been lost to sea. Tribal lands in the state's southeast are among the most affected. As our New Orleans Communities correspondent Robbie Chavez reports, one volunteer-led effort is gaining attention in the fight against coastal erosion with an unlikely tool, recycled oyster shells.
A boat ride through the marshes of southeastern Louisiana is a painful reminder of the state's quickly disappearing coastline. It's a swath of land that includes important cultural sites. Trees anchor tribal mounds, some older than Stonehenge. By some estimates, the state is losing at least two mounds per year. Teresa Dardar is a member of the Pointe-aux-Chenes Indian tribe. For years, she felt helpless watching parts of the tribe's sacred land fall into the water. To help protect the land from rapid erosion, the tribe partnered with the nonprofit Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana and use recycled oyster shells from local restaurants to build artificial reefs.
They're helping us to try to save what we want to save. It makes you feel so good to see that people do care, that they're not just here to see what's happening. You know, they're here because they care.
The Coalition used nearly 400 tons of shells to create oyster reefs that now cover 800 feet of coastline near the tribal mounds. So far, their project is working. The Coalition's reefs have withstood Hurricane Ida in 2021 and slowed shoreline erosion by as much as 50%.
We take a product that used to get sent to the landfill, but is very useful in slowing coastal land loss, and we put it back into the water where it belongs.
James Karst works with the Coalition. He says the artificial reefs are designed to mimic nature, providing coastal protection for years to come.
Once these reefs are in place, tell us what happens to them just organically.
Life begins to grow on them. Baby oysters are attracted to the old oyster shells, and they attach to them and they begin to grow. And that is why they are considered to be living shorelines. To me, it is sort of the ultimate sustainable seafood. It's really a win-win-win because oysters also filter the water. They can help to minimize storm surge during hurricanes and tropical storms, and they slow the rate of erosion by a significant amount.
In one of the largest shell recycling programs in the nation, the Coalition has so far built 5 oyster reefs, protecting 8,000 feet of disappearing shoreline. In all, 13 million pounds of shells have been recycled. Louisiana is the nation's top oyster producer, and nearly 50 restaurants now participate in the recycling program that keeps their oysters out of landfills. James Klesse is the co-owner of Klesse's Seafood Restaurant. He says signing up for the program was a no-brainer.
We go through a lot of oysters. I don't want to say, you know, thousands and thousands of pounds. And it's really cool to know that they're going right back to water to help the oyster lifestyle. It gets really easy just to order the oysters, cook them, shuck them, serve them, and not really know where they came from. And it gave us an opportunity for us to learn the whole life cycle of the oyster, how important it is to the Louisiana coastline, and the way of life for everybody that lives down there.
Back on the water, Teresa Dardar and her husband Donald know the oyster reefs won't be a cure-all. They're also fighting to backfill oil and gas exploration canals that cut into the marsh. But for now, it no longer feels like they are alone in the fight. For the PBS NewsHour in New Orleans, I'm Robbie Chavez.
And join us online right now to watch the 15th annual Congressional Women's Softball Game, where members of Congress take on the press, whose team features our own Lisa Desjardins, Amy Walter, Tamara Keith, and other NewsHour staffers. Watch starting at 7 p.m. Eastern on our website, pbs.org/newshour, or on our YouTube page.
And join us again here tomorrow night for more on the writer's strike and potential actor strike in Hollywood. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Have a great evening.